important that there is an agency that is fully functional and able to make sure that money that is being received is being done so legally, that it's not coming from illegal sources, certainly not from foreign sources.
And the other thing is that even before there was no quorum, it was basically non-functional and in total gridlock. But it doesn't appear at this point that President Trump or Senate Democrats are making haste to work out their differences and get that back up to a quorum.
Well, another story on this list of stories that may have gotten drowned out, one out of every four U.S. circuit court judges in this country have been confirmed since President Trump took office. I mean, there's a reshaping of the judiciary happening.
Right. And this is sort of one of those stories that is happening every week in the U.S. Senate. Even as the House was voting on impeachment, the Senate was confirming more of President Trump's judicial nominees. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell boasted about his success on Hugh Hewitt's radio show recently.
President Obama appointed 55 circuit judges in 8 years. President Trump, with our Senate confirmation, has done 50 in 3 years.
And they're all going to be on the court for a very long time, a generation, likely helping to shape policy through judicial decisions. President Trump talks about this regularly at campaign events, and it's one of the things that he sells, especially to evangelical voters. It's sort of like, you may not like the way I talk or some of the things I do, but just look at the judges.
Well, another story that ebbs and flows is the news about the president's financial conflicts. There were all these questions when it was announced that the next G7 summit would be at this golf course that the president owns near Miami. This was in October, and Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House chief of staff, was talking about the concerns people had.
He knows exactly that he's going to get these questions and exactly get that reaction from a lot of people. And he's simply saying, OK, that's fine. I'm willing to take that. The same way he takes it when he goes to Trump Mar-a-Lago, the same place when he goes to play Trump Bedminster. He got over that a long time ago. We absolutely believe this is the best place to have it. We're going to have it there.
So, Tim, remind us what happened next.
Well, they didn't have it there. They had to back down. The White House faced a huge amount of pushback, even from Republicans in Congress, and they backed down, and now it's going to be at Camp David. But he points to something that would have been a huge story with any other president, but because it's President Trump and there's so much of it, it gets lost. According to the GAO, a government watchdog, it costs taxpayers about $3 million a trip when President Trump visits Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, which is where he is right now. There are trips to Bedminster, New Jersey, where he has a golf club. And of course, some of those expenses to the government are paid to President Trump's resorts. Then there's the Trump Hotel in downtown Washington, where the president dines, where political fundraisers are held, and where people who are trying to curry favor with the president hold events or book a big block of rooms. Of course, the president says that he has his hands off of this, that it's being run by his sons, but then sometimes he promotes his properties on Twitter.
And then, Tam, there were also these photos of President Trump on social media just this past weekend at Mar-a-Lago, meeting with Eddie Gallagher. This was a story about a clemency decision. Gallagher was acquitted of murdering a captive ISIS fighter, but convicted for posing with the corpse. And the president insisted that Gallagher be allowed to retire as a Navy SEAL, keep his trident pin. Here's what the president said.
He wanted to take his pin away, and I said, no, you're not going to take it away. He was a great fighter. He was one of the ultimate fighters.
It's a really controversial story, Tam.
Incredibly controversial, and he overruled the military brass and pardoned two service members, one who was in military prison for killing two civilians, another who was charged with killing a civilian. For all these cases, President Trump was lobbied by prominent conservatives who talked about the cases on Fox News. He overruled military leaders, and the Gallagher case led to the firing of Navy Secretary Richard Spencer, who clashed with the president on this.
Just some of the stories that have been drowned out in the news cycle in 2019. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, thanks.
You're welcome.
The 2010s in Europe started with a financial crisis that threatened to break up the European Union. In the middle of the decade, more than a million migrants from the Middle East arrived. And at the end of the decade, populist movements are now threatening European cohesion. Through it all, there has been Germany's chancellor, Angela Merkel. But Merkel says she won't seek re-election in 2021, and she's already stepped down as leader of her Christian Democratic Party. NPR's Rob Schmitz has this review of Merkel's decade.
Angela Merkel is not a passionate speaker. She doesn't arouse the public with big ideas or big promises. Her personality probably wouldn't make her a great candidate for, say, president of the U.S. But, says Merkel biographer Stefan Cornelius, her quiet technocratic style through the past decade has been a perfect fit for Germany.
People don't want to have the sort of visionary thing and being led with flying flags. They just want to have predictability and the guarantee that things are calm and under control. And she gave that guarantee for pretty much all of her rule.
And she's done so through a decade when Europe's cohesion was constantly under threat.
Wir biegen unsere Verträge und Regeln so weit.
July 2015, Merkel takes the podium at the Bundestag, Germany's parliament, and argues for a third financial bailout for Greece. The decade began with a financial crisis that impacted the EU. The economy of Greece falls apart, unemployment is on the rise, and violent protests are on the street of Athens. By the summer of 2015, Greece is on the verge of leaving the Eurozone.
Und es ist deshalb mit uns nicht zu machen.
Merkel tells her government they cannot sit back and watch. And they didn't. Greece was bailed out and the EU held together.
You know, Merkel's approach was to do whatever it takes to prevent the EU from falling apart.
Joseph Janning is a former senior policy fellow of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
She has been remarkably successful because there were severe crises, there were profound challenges to the integrity and the coherence of the EU, and it survived.
Among the tough decisions she's made in the past decade, phasing out nuclear power after the Fukushima disaster, standing up to Putin when Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine, and allowing around 1 million war refugees to resettle in Germany. However, Janning says many of these decisions did not go far enough. He says after the Greek debt crisis, Merkel could have fought to strengthen the EU's fiscal authority over member states, but she didn't. In the wake of the refugee crisis, she could have worked harder to achieve a common EU immigration and asylum legislation, agency, and border police to manage the issue, but that eluded her as well. Senior Brookings fellow Constanze Steltenmuller says Merkel's hallmark style of solving problems through compromise, always choosing a middle path, may have prevented lasting solutions to Europe's biggest problems.
Merkel, like Clinton, and I think in this she imitated Clinton, espoused a kind of technocratic, there is no alternative centrism that took the belief, the identity factor out of politics, or rather pushed it to the sidelines where it was taken up by the extremists.
And those extremists, says Steltenmuller, have gained ground during a leadership that has put compromise ahead of ideology. The right-wing AfD party is more popular than ever in Germany. And now, at the end of the decade, many EU countries are run by populist leaders who see Merkel's leadership as outdated, says Joseph Janning.
They reject this ultra-pragmatic bargaining approach and rather create disruption by breaking with the rules, breaking with the establishment, breaking with the institutions of the parties in their own countries, and rather concentrating a lot of power on themselves and on a leadership circle around them.
And these threats to democracy are precisely why Merkel has been a crucial leader in the past decade, argues Stefan Cornelius.
She will stand as an example on how democracy lives from compromise, from finding the middle ground, from not overreaching, and definitely not from arousing people wherever you step and go.
Cornelius says Merkel has kept alight the flame of liberal democracy during a decade when the foundation of democracy was shaken, when populists were on the rise, and when the West as a unifying ideal with the U.S. at its helm was collapsing. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 19 past 8, and you're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. On the way, the federal government says homelessness has been rising for 3 years, and it's mostly because of California. In 15 minutes, we'll look at the scale of the crisis and what's being done about it.
Are you 70 and a half years old or older? Do you have a traditional IRA? Are you looking for a convenient, tax-free way to support the WPR programs you enjoy? The IRA charitable rollover is the answer. You can take your required annual distribution in the form of a gift to charity. Talk to your financial advisor or visit WPRlegacy.org for more information. Make a difference for WPR programs today. Thank you.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
The fog continues for the state. A dense fog advisory in effect through early afternoon for the northern two-thirds of Wisconsin. In the south today, partly sunny. In central Wisconsin, a chance of freezing drizzle. And in the north, drizzle and snow in the morning, then cloudy and breezy, highs from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. Partly to mostly sunny skies in the forecast tomorrow, with highs from the upper 20s to upper 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the YMCA, a nonprofit working to fill gaps and bridge divides in 10,000 U.S. communities. Details about the impact of donations are available at ymca.net/giving. The Y for a better us. From Americans for the Arts, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, supporting the nonprofit arts industry, which employs 4.6 million people nationwide. Learn more at AmericansForTheArts.org. And from TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. It is one of the world's most expensive spices and most difficult to grow. It's also in great demand. Vanilla is fetching top dollars these days. In Mexico, though, where vanilla originated and has been cultivated for centuries, it's struggling to survive. As NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, it's the latest victim of the country's growing violence and criminal gangs.
Oscar Ramirez walks up a steep mountain path cutting through lush trees and thick green bushes. He's 29 years old and just started up an association of vanilla growers here in Papantla, a small town in the Gulf Coast state of Veracruz.
Está escondido, está en medio de la nada, hasta acá lo tenemos que tener.
This is where we have to grow these days, out here in the middle of nowhere, he says, hidden from the thieves. Thanks to rising demand and poor weather in other vanilla-producing countries, mainly Madagascar, Mexican vanilla is fetching 10,000 pesos a kilo, about $250 a pound. That's good news for local farmers, but it's also made them a tempting target for Mexico's growing organized crime gangs. Many have diversified, trafficking in everything from stolen gasoline, black market gold, and pilfered agricultural goods like avocados, and here in Veracruz, vanilla, especially once cut from the vines and drying out in the open, like this crop we finally come upon. We just got to the top of the summit, and I could see a little clearing that they've made where they're drying pounds and pounds of the vanilla, and the aroma of the vanilla just wafts up from the valley floor and hits you. It's amazing. Ramirez says vanilla used to be dried in the center of Papantla. In the crop's heyday, mid-last century, Totonacan Indians sprawled their harvest out in the town square, giving Papantla its catchy slogan, the city that perfumes the world.
No, que daba gusto verlo.
What a joy it was seeing it carpet the whole town, says 62-year-old Adolfo San Martin Garcia. He's standing in the town square in his traditional indigenous dress. He remembers helping his grandfather with his crop in the late 1960s. It was the Totonacans who introduced vanilla to the world. They used it to pay tribute to their Aztec overlords, who spiced their hot chocolate with it. When the conquistador Hernan Cortes arrived in Mexico in the early 1500s, the Aztecs served him the drink. Among the many riches Cortes pillaged and took back to Spain were Mexico's vanilla plants. San Martin Garcia says growing vanilla takes a lot of hard work, and he gave it up as a teen. turning instead to making easier money performing for tourists visiting this picturesque town. It's not just the loss of the older generation of farmers that worries Oscar Ramirez of the Vanilla Association. As he drives around his hometown, he says young farmers want a faster, less risky crop. Like his friend Hector Canales Villa, a local orange grower. Canales says he can get more than just one harvest per year out of oranges. And the vanilla orchid blossoms just one day a year. It has to be hand-pollinated. Bees in the region have long been on the decline. And then the long pods take 9 months to fully mature. After that, it takes up to 2 more months to properly dry it.
Hemos vivido situaciones de inseguridad también nosotros.
But he adds our industry isn't totally immune from Mexico's rising violence either. He was recently kidnapped and held for 5 days until his family paid a ransom.
Sí, creo que no hay vainillero al que no le hayan robado.
Back in his car, Ramirez says he doesn't know a grower who hasn't been a crime victim. Vanilla no longer fills the hills of his hometown. Total acreage has dropped 90% in the past 50 years. He's worried Mexican vanilla will soon go extinct. Third-generation vanilla farmer Juan Salazar Garcia says he's been lucky this season. No thefts so far. He looks over a ton of his vanilla drying in the small mountain clearing.
Entonces, gran parte de, del amor que le tenemos a la vainilla, pues fue inculcado por ellos.
My grandfather and father were vanilla farmers, and they instilled the love of this crop and its history in me, he says. I'm staying put. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Papantla, Veracruz.
Colorado has a New Year's Eve tradition that goes back 97 years. People watch fireworks launched from the top of Pikes Peak. It's one of the state's highest mountains. But that means a crew has to hike up through hurricane-force winds and temperatures as low as 50 below zero to ignite the display. Abigail Beckman from member station KRCC in Colorado Springs brought us this.
They're called the Adaman Club, named for the tradition of adding one man or woman to their ranks each year. On a brief training hike in Pikes Peak's massive shadow, club president Dan Stewart says hiking in the snow is something he looks forward to.
I think you have to be a little twisted to do this kind of thing in the middle of winter, but some people really love it and other people don't apply.
Yes, people actually apply to do this, and it's tough to get in. If you haven't climbed a few dozen massive mountains in the winter, then you probably won't make the cut. 68-year-old Ted Lindemann completed his first hike with the group at age 16. This year will be his 50th trip up the mountain, as he's only missed the hike 3 times.
1 year I was living in Vermont. 1 year I realized I'd married the wrong girl. And another year I was writing a thesis. But so at least 2 of those are good excuses.
This year's new member is Dan Stewart's son, Tyler. He's climbed with the group before. This time he'll lead the way, following a trail even when it's under the snow.
But there are times when it's hard to keep track, and at least 1 year where we just turned and went straight uphill, which is awful, but it worked.
The group that started this is known locally as the Frozen Five. They braved the peak's treacherous terrain in 1922 with far less sophisticated gear than is available now. But just like the old-timers, last year's crew celebrated with rockets and bursts of flame. Matt Mayberry, a local historian, says the hike harkens to a mentality in Colorado Springs that has existed throughout the life of the city.
We have such a firm and enduring link to the mountain. And even in the depths of the winter, at midnight on New Year's Eve, you know, that mountain is still the chief thing that many of us in Colorado Springs think about.
Especially as they watch the fireworks. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Beckman in Colorado Springs.
This is NPR News.
Two friends who used to be music snobs had an awakening one day on a road trip. Hey, I
just met you. It was this amazing aha moment.
They started analyzing pop songs the way you might approach jazz or classical.
It still seems that we're allowed to say, hey, I like this music, but that music is bad.
First they made a podcast, now they have a book, Switched on Pop, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Morning Edition on WPR. In state news, the number of students enrolling in virtual charter schools in Wisconsin has increased by 140% over the last decade. We'll hear more about that trend just ahead after the latest news from NPR. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Italy's education minister has announced he's stepping down. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports the resignation is a blow to the embattled government, whose ruling parties are at odds on issues ranging from Eurozone reform to migrant rights.
Lorenzo Fioramonte quit in protest after the 2020 budget approved on Monday did not include his request for increased funding for Italy's schools and universities. He had drawn international interest when he announced the introduction next year of climate change classes from elementary through high school grades. Italian media reported Fioramonte will leave the Maverick Five-Star Movement and form a new independent party.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reporting from Rome. China is set to pass legislation ending an extrajudicial system of detention. NPR's Emily Fang reports the detention had been used for decades as a way of rounding up sex workers and their clients.
The legislation is expected to pass Saturday and outlaws what's called custody and education, which allows authorities to detain sex workers for up to 2 years without a trial. Other types of extrajudicial detention have been abolished before, including a type of forced labor for petty criminals and dissidents. But critics say new forms of detention have quickly emerged to replace them.
NPR's Emily Fang. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 33 points. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The number of students attending Wisconsin virtual charter schools has more than doubled over the last decade. In 2019, seven new virtual charter schools opened in Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, Elmwood, Lake Geneva, and Ripon. Supporters say students get a more personalized K-12 experience. But UW Oshkosh Professor of Public Administration Michael Ford says they also have high turnover rates, which can hurt test scores.
The virtual charter sector is still relatively new. Don't have the best data and understanding what's the best way to even teach these specific subjects in a virtual setting, and how do we do it well.
7,500 students took classes at 42 online charter programs last school year. Democratic Governor Tony Evers says he thinks Taiwan-based Foxconn will eventually renegotiate its contract with the state. WISN-TV reports that the governor said Monday that conversations are ongoing. The Evers administration has notified Foxconn officials they no longer qualify for major state tax credits because of the nature of the project having changed. Company officials have disputed the notion and questioned whether the Evers administration was friendly to business. In a November 18th letter to the state, Foxconn wrote, quote, "At this point, we shall be evaluating all available options relating to the WEDIC contract." Evers said he didn't know what that meant. He said the state is willing to defend itself should any action be taken to court. Three Madison police officers who fatally shot a drunken man after he fired at them have been cleared of any criminal wrongdoing. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that a prosecutor on Monday cleared Sergeant Ryan Gibson and officers Sonny Martinez and Justin Nelson of any criminal wrongdoing in the killing of 63-year-old Dean Thomas in October. Thomas was shot after police responded to a 911 call about a man firing a gun. Thomas opened fire on the officers, who returned fire and killed him. A large number of people donated kidneys to strangers in 2019 at the University of Wisconsin Hospital in Madison, in what marked a big increase over previous years. There were 28 people who gave their kidneys to strangers. The UW Hospital had its first non-directed donor in 2003, and from then until 2017, there were an average of 4 such donors every year. Last year, the number increased to 12 before increasing to 28 this year. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wildlands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Some new federal data shows that most U.S. states are seeing declines in homelessness, which is good news. But overall, the number of homeless people in this country is going up. So what is happening here? The answer lies on the West Coast, especially in California, where the numbers of homeless people just keep rising. Erica Smith is a writer and editor at the Los Angeles Times, and she covers homelessness. She's on the line now. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning.
So last week, I read a story that you wrote where you said this was the year that homelessness truly felt like a crisis in Los Angeles. What are you seeing that made you write that?
Well, I mean, I think that for years, homelessness was pretty much confined to the downtown area of L.A., mostly Skid Row and at times in Hollywood. But in the last couple of years, it's spread into different neighborhoods and places that you wouldn't expect. I mean, personally, I live on the west side in Marina Del Rey. And one night I came home to find a homeless guy who was sleeping between the wall and my car my parking garage underground. And, you know, I think these are incidents that residents are facing more often where you're seeing somebody that you don't necessarily want on your property, but you know, your hesitation to call the police or to do something about it is a little bit different because you also don't want to be heartless. And so I think as this crisis continues to balloon, it's affecting residents. Obviously, it's affecting homeless people who are out there on the streets deteriorating. And, you know, it's just becoming a bigger and bigger crisis. It's harder to ignore.
Why are things getting worse?
Well, I think it's easy to kind of look at the numbers and say this is something that happened recently, but the reality is this is something that's happened over years. California has not kept up with home building, and so there's a severe housing shortage, and so rents are going up because of supply and demand. There are not enough, wages are not going up. But also, I think what doesn't get talked about enough is a few years ago, the state kind of made a decision to invest more in permanent supportive housing, and a lot of funds went to that. But at the same time, there are a lot of shelters that weren't built and other things that were more temporary in nature. And so I think as the state is focused more on these longer term solutions, which are very much mainstream and what other states have done in California, that longer term solutions has been longer than other states. And so in the meantime, the homeless population has skyrocketed.
Okay, this is really interesting. I just want to untangle a little bit of what you said there. You've reported that California residents have voted, city residents have voted. They have okayed hundreds of millions of dollars for new housing and services. The problem, it sounds like what you're saying is it's going to longer term projects like building houses and not to immediate solutions. So you have people on the streets for that reason.
That's one of the reasons I think so. I mean, I think the other reason is a lot of the money that LA voters and California voters have voted to approve, it's going into the pipeline. Like, for example, in LA, there was Proposition HHH. That was a huge housing ballot measure for housing. And that money has been allocated. But a lot of those projects are taking years to get off the ground. The first one's supposed to open in January, even though that ballot measure has been on the books for a couple of years now. So it's the time that it takes to build. It's the decisions that policymakers made, you know, a few years ago looking at the crisis. And it's just basically how things have evolved, where the economy is still red hot. People are still making lots of money, but a lot of people just aren't. Their wages aren't keeping up. And so you have basically a huge income inequality and a huge wage gap.
Is there, I wonder, any chance of things improving in the next year? Now that, people are calling it a crisis, you're saying it's in everyone's face, including people whose faces it normally wasn't in. Can we look forward to improvement next year?
Well, the good thing is a lot of the housing that was promised, at least in LA County, is going to start coming online next year. As I mentioned, the first one is going to open supposedly in January. A few others are slated to open as well. The city has managed to open at least 10 shelters that were planned. And there were also basically rent caps are going to go into effect. So there's a possibility that fewer people will be evicted as well.
Some good news, possibly.
Yep.
Erica Smith of the Los Angeles Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
Alaska is warming twice as fast as the global average. This year is expected to be the warmest on record in Anchorage. As Nat Herz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, this is changing residents' winter way of life.
At Anchorage's Kincaid Park, high school teams have driven hours to compete at an annual cross-country ski race. It's a near wilderness setting packed with moose and traversed by 30 miles of ski trails. But on this day, most of the snow has melted. Hundreds of racers take turns skiing around a mile-long loop of man-made snow that's surrounded by treacherous sheets of ice. Max Beiergrossline is a senior who placed fourth, and he wasn't thrilled about racing on what he called a gerbil loop.
It's not the best, like, going to bed at night thinking, like, oh, there's not going to be, like, snow tomorrow.
Bargrosslein and the other racers warmed up not by skiing, but by jogging around a field next to the race course. This kind of a scene has become increasingly common over the past few years here, but Bargrosslein says that more people signed up for his high school ski team this winter than he's ever seen.
When it was first having bad snow years, a lot of people would, like, quit because we would be running a lot. But now people are just, like, it's kind of all they know.
Welcome to the new reality for Alaska's largest city, which is in the midst of redefining its relationship with winter. Across town, in the back of a shop called Skinny Raven Sports, John Clark is drilling a set of hardened screws into the soles of a pair of sneakers. It's a cheap way to get better traction on icy streets and trails.
So we get them by the box load, thousands of them.
Out on the sales floor, for people willing to spend more, the store has a dozen models of shoes with built-in studs. Clark says the store once sold a few hundred pairs a year, but icy winters have helped drive up demand.
We'll probably sell well over 1,000 units of studded shoes a year, so it's an important part of our business.
The changes have brought other adjustments to daily life in Anchorage. One elementary school principal has suggested that students wear helmets at recess to keep them safe on an icy playground. Anchorage's street maintenance department recently started using salt along with sand to help clear certain roads. And the city council just voted to shorten the season in which Anchorage drivers are allowed to use studded tires. Alaska scientists are now researching how much of a change there's been in what are known as rain-on-snow events, which create ice. And then they'll use that data to predict what may happen in the future. But they already know that it's staying warmer later in the fall and taking longer for snow to build up, especially in the past 5 years. Brian Brettschneider is a local climatologist with the International Arctic Research Center.
I mean, my kids are now 12 and 14, and they talk about what it used to be like.
Brettschneider is an avid winter hiker, and he says that he and other Anchorage residents relish their snowy winters.
It's kind of a badge of honor that we experience this, we get through it, we endure it, but we also embrace it.
If the warmer, icier trend continues, Brettschneider says, the city risks losing a core piece of its identity. For NPR News, I'm Nat Herz in Anchorage.
We appreciate you listening this morning on your public radio station. You can find all of us who host this program on Twitter. I'm at NPR Green. Noelle is at Noelle King. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR. Steve Inskeep is at NPR Inskeep. But we are just the hosts. There's an entire team of colleagues who do the real work here getting this show on the air. And you can find all of them if you go to npr.org, go over to the Morning Edition page, click on staff, and meet all of our colleagues. You can follow a lot of them on Twitter. They are tweeting things that are a lot more fun and interesting than I am. This is NPR News.
He is right. It does take a team. Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening today. Coming up, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services wants to make it more expensive to obtain immigration records. That means, among other things, that access to some genealogical records kept by the U.S. government may get a lot more expensive to obtain. Genealogist Renee Carl talks with David Green coming up in 9 minutes.
Many American cities recovered from the high crime rates of the 80s because of kids playing in their front yards.
It made the street much more active and much more social. And we know that when there are a lot of people keeping an eye on things on the street, that tends to drive down crime.
I'm Kimberly Adams, the revival of American cities, next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
There are 54,000 individuals and families who contribute to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to their investment, you can hear your favorite programs and discover new ones all over Wisconsin and beyond. Thank you.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR, and here are some of this morning's stories. Afghanistan's defense ministry says that a powerful suicide car bombing has targeted an army compound in the country's north, killing six Afghan soldiers. The Taliban quickly claimed responsibility for the attack, saying also that they captured the military compound. Prosecutors say California attorney Michael Avenatti was over $15 million in debt when he tried to extort up to $25 million from Nike, but his lawyers say the money he illegally requested to conduct an internal probe of the sportswear giant was a bargain. Both sides made the assertions in court papers filed late Tuesday in advance of a January 22nd criminal trial in Manhattan. And volunteer firefighters would get housing help under new bipartisan legislation that's being championed by U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. Details of that story and all the latest news in 15 minutes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, guided by the belief that the arts and humanities are essential to the well-being of diverse and democratic societies. Learn more at mellon.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. The State Department has recalled the U.S. ambassador to Zambia after Zambia's president asked for him to be withdrawn. Ambassador Daniel Foote is a career Foreign Service officer, and last month he criticized a court ruling that sentenced two Zambian men to 15 years in jail for having a sexual relationship. That started a fight between him and Zambian officials. NPR East Africa correspondent Ader Peralta is following this from Nairobi. Hey, Ader.
Hey, Noel.
So Zambia is not a place that we hear a lot from or about. What's it like there?
Yeah, so we're talking about Southern Africa, and it's a country that's a little bigger than Texas. And the reason we don't hear a lot about it is because there's little drama. It's a functional democracy. Since the 90s, there have been peaceful transfers of power. But things are changing. The country isn't doing great economically because the price of copper, which Zambia has a ton of, has dropped. And activists say that this particular government is tending more authoritarian. This episode with the American ambassador, they say, is an example of that.
So what did Ambassador Foote do that made the government so angry?
So as you said, it started last month with this court ruling where they sentenced two men to 15 years in prison for having sex with each other. The ambassador said he was horrified, and the Zambian government basically told him to mind his own business. And Ambassador Daniel Foote then unloaded. He released a diplomatic statement that I have seen, you know, few as pointed as this one was. And he said that the U.S. had saved more than 1 million lives in Zambia with just its HIV programs. And then he went on to accuse the government of being hypocritical, of outright stealing millions of dollars intended to go to important welfare programs. He said that while the corrupt officials doing that don't even get a slap on the wrist, two men having sex get 15 years in jail. And then he said that everyone should just stop pretending that the U.S. and Zambia have cordial relations. He wrote, and I'm quoting now, "The current government of Zambia wants foreign diplomats to be compliant with open pocketbooks and closed mouths."
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. So this was about way, way more than just a homophobic court ruling.
Yeah, for sure. And Zambian President Edgar Lungu was seething mad, and he essentially declared the ambassador a persona non grata, and the U.S. had to pull him out of the country. Today, I spoke to Fumba Chama. He's an activist and a musician who has faced the wrath of this government. Last year, he was thrown in jail for a song that criticized the president, and just a few days ago, he was arrested and charged with holding an unlawful assembly. I asked him what it says about Zambia that someone with as much leverage as the American ambassador can be forced out in this way. And he tells me that this is much bigger than the United States. Let's listen.
I think we as a people have lost the battle. Because I'll tell you, what Ambassador Foote was doing was giving a voice to so many of us that are scared to say what he said.
So what this means, he says, is that Zambia just lost a powerful voice at what he says is an urgent moment for a country moving in the wrong direction.
Where does this leave the U.S. and Zambia now? Do we send a new ambassador?
Yeah, so, you know, both sides still have significant interests. The U.S. sends $500 million with a B dollars a year in aid to Zambia. So I think what we can expect is that a new ambassador will be named, and both sides are just going to have to live with each other.
NPR's Eder Peralta in Nairobi. Eder, thanks so much.
Thank you, Noel.
This is NPR News.
10 minutes before 9, Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up after the latest news, just after 9 o'clock, we'll have classical music for you with Stephanie Elkins, and she'll begin with a piano sonata, a well-known one by Beethoven. Also in the first hour of music, Antonin Dvorak's My Home Overture. And later in the morning, Hatarina Rospighi's Suite No. 3 of Ancient Airs and Dances. Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins coming up.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and SportsWeb, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app.
Continent, High Life, Hip Life, Mikasa, and more with DJ Teddy. Find out more at WPR.org/events.
In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks lost to the Philadelphia 76ers 121-109 yesterday. The Sixers played their first home game on Christmas in 31 years and controlled most of the game against the Bucks. The Bucks had the best record in the NBA. A dense fog advisory remains in effect through early afternoon for the northern two-thirds of the state. Partly sunny in the south today. In central Wisconsin, some freezing drizzle possible. In the north, drizzle and snow this morning, then cloudy and breezy. Highs from the mid-30s to mid-40s. On Friday, partly to mostly sunny skies. Highs from the upper 20s to upper 30s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. It might get a lot more expensive to try and trace your family's roots. Many people who immigrated to the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s have files at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. That agency now wants to raise the prices to obtain these records, not by a little bit, but by something like 500%. Renee Carl is with me. She's a genealogist who works with clients who use these records. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure, David.
So can you start by telling us what records are actually held by this agency?
There are millions of records held at this agency. A files, which are alien files, naturalization certificate files, or C files, visa files, you applied for a visa to come to the United States. There might be something called a registry file if during the process of naturalization, the government couldn't find you on a ship manifest, so they were trying to document how you entered the country in the first place.
You can literally put together people's lives through doing this research here.
This is immigration history. If someone is coming from a displaced persons camp in Europe, they would have filled out all this paperwork while still in Europe. Then you get the information on when they come in. You get a photograph. If there's a visa file, you almost always get a photograph.
You can see a picture of the person in your family.
Right, and sometimes you've never seen a picture of your great-grandfather or your grandfather other than as a grandfather, not as a young person.
Yeah.
You always get signatures. If you don't get a photo, you're going to get a signature, which is a way to have that human touch in a record.
You must see people's eyes just light up as they get a hold of these records.
This gives you a way to understand what their lives were like when you can't ask them the questions anymore.
Are there certain populations who seem to use the service more than others?
Any person who's researching their immigrant history would potentially find something in these records. But there are a couple populations that are disproportionately impacted because of immigration laws. People of Japanese descent who were not citizens until after World War II. People of Chinese descent who were subject to the Chinese Exclusion Act and therefore weren't citizens until after 1952. Their records are only going to be found by requesting USCIS to give them the records of their families.
Hmm. You did some of your own research through the service on your family, right?
Yes. Most professional genealogists start out by experimenting on their own family.
Uh-huh.
The first time I filed an application to get information from USCIS was about my grandfather.
Wow. What'd you learn?
So my grandfather came to this country as a child and became a citizen. But in the 1960s, my grandfather had no idea where his certificate of naturalization was. He wanted a copy of it that had his name on it. And he also needed to prove how old he was to Social Security so he could start collecting his benefits. Being from Eastern Europe and coming here as a child, he did not have a birth certificate. So in order to prove his age, there were letters in his file from the St. Louis School Board saying that he started first grade at age 7. It gave the name of the school that he attended. These are these little things that obviously no one alive today is going to know, but it gave me this insight into a person as a child. We don't think of our grandparents as children. We think of them as grandparents. And you realize they had this whole life that they live. So these records are one way to take a peek back into a different part of our immigrant ancestors' lives.
So these fee increases, I mean, I know it's very confusing, but is there any way to say roughly like what it would cost a person if these changes go through compared to what it used to cost?
At minimum, it would cost $240 to put in a request and receive records from USCIS under these proposed changes.
So that's just paying the money to look, and there might not be anything that comes up.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, some of the records would be included in that $240 fee, but if there is a paper file, they would add on another $385 to the fee. So that's a total of $625 for one file on one person.
And up to this point, you probably wouldn't spend even anywhere close to $100 for all that?
Right now, it's $65 for a search in their master index, and then it's another $65 to receive the records.
I mean, there's a big difference for
people.
There's
a huge difference. It's already expensive for records that should be at the National Archives. Many of these records should be at National Archives and free for people to access.
I guess I just want to ask you, I mean, as important as these files are to people, I mean, the press release from the agency is basically saying they're overextended. They haven't collected enough fees to cover doing these applications. And so it's basically been partially subsidizing this. What is the argument that the government should be partially subsidizing this service?
These records represent the history of 20th century immigration in our country. Our immigrant ancestors paid and filed fees when they filled out the forms in the first place. If these records were transferred over to the National Archives, they would be available for research. And these records would then be held in a place that's used to handling records all the time, not in an agency that focuses on immigration and naturalization.
Thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Renee Carl is a genealogist, and we should say the public can send comments to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services as part of its public comment period, which ends on December 30th.
All right, we're ending 2019 with a discovery that helps us understand the universe better. A research team in China found a massive black hole, 70 times the mass of the sun. The lead researcher says black holes of such mass should not even exist in our galaxy.
Okay, so to help us understand the impact of this finding, we reached out to astrophysicist Brooke Simmons at Lancaster University in Great Britain.
If this pans out, it's really exciting because it tells us that there's something we fundamentally don't understand about how black holes are forming, or at least how some black holes can form.
At 300 miles across, this one is more massive than the researchers thought was theoretically possible in the Milky Way.
Now, even at that size, black holes are hard to find. In this case, the researchers looked for stuff being pulled in by the black hole's gravity.
So they basically measure how a star that is in the orbit of the black hole is orbiting around the black hole by measuring the velocity. So that's a completely new technique.
Professor David Reitze is director of the LIGO Laboratory, and he says one possibility is this was actually formed by two less massive black holes smashing into each other.
Which is very cool because it's the first time something has been seen in our Milky Way galaxy that has that characteristic.
And if you're worried about being sucked into the void, it's all good. The monster black hole is 15,000 light years away.
Black hole sun, won't you come?
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. Join us this afternoon for BBC News Hour beginning at 3, and then it's All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. It's a minute before 9, and stay tuned. The latest news is next, followed by classical music.
Support for WPR comes from Explore La Crosse, featuring Rotary Lights, November 25th through the end of the year. Set along the Mississippi with Santa nightly, outdoor skating, and more than 4 million lights. ExploreLacrosse.com.
Support comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. With the holidays approaching, these can be difficult times. If you are struggling, having a bad day, or need someone to listen, text HOPELINE to 741-741 for free crisis counseling 24/7.
You're listening to WGTD HD.